WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 45 years ago, an integrated group of self-proclaimed freedom riders challenged segregation by riding together on buses through the Deep South. They demanded unrestricted access to segregated buses, as well as bus terminal restaurants and waiting rooms. The freedom riders were pledged to nonviolence and kept that pledge even when attacked and bloodied by their racist opponents. My guest Raymond Arsenault has written a new book called The Freedom Riders. Before we meet him, we're going to hear an excerpt of an interview I recorded with James Farmer, a co-founder of The Riders and of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. In this 1985 interview, he described a turning point for the Freedom Riders when the group he was traveling with was arrested in Mississippi.
There were three charges: disobeying an officer, disturbing the peace, and inciting to riot. We were arrested by Captain Ray, who was the chief of police of the city of Jackson, when he ordered me to move on. And I asked where. The young lady with me, who had locked arms with me, she and I were about to go into the restaurant there in the waiting room, the white waiting room, for dinner. And other freedom riders followed the two of us, and were similarly told to get into the paddy wagon. And we were taken to jail. Then I sent orders by my lawyer to my CORE staff in New York to begin immediately recruiting freedom riders, white and black, from all over the country, sending them into Jackson to try, in true Gandhian fashion, to fill up the jails. We were not going to bail out. We were going to stay in as long as we could stay in and still file an appeal, and that turned out to be 40 days and 40 nights.
Did the jails want you out?
Yes. They quickly found out that we were not going to bail out right away, and then what they wanted to do was to make it so uncomfortable for us that we'd wish we had never come, and we'd stop others from coming. They did not physically beat us, though they tried once at one place, and that backfired because I got one young man bailed out, and he called the FBI, and he also held a press conference, so that stopped the physical brutality. But they did such things as putting so much salt in the food that we couldn't eat it. Many of us were chain smokers, and we were denied any cigarettes, but the guards would walk by our cells puffing on cigarettes and blowing the smoke into our cells at great length. We were students or readers. They denied us any newspapers or any books, refused to let any come in, refused to let us have any paper or any pencils to do any writing whatsoever. We were denied any visitors except our lawyer. This was psychological brutality.
You were also banned from singing at one point.
Well, they tried to stop us from singing. We sang all the freedom songs we knew, and we made up new ones. I made up one song, wrote one song. Actually, it was, I put new words to an old labor song, "Which Side Are You On?"
What were the words you wrote?
Well, these words, I can't sing, so I won't even try to sing it. Said, "Come all you freedom fighters, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old freedom ride has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? 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 They say in Hinds County," where Jackson was, Jackson, Mississippi, "no neutrals have they met. You're either for the freedom ride or you're Tom for Ross Barnett." He was the governor of Mississippi. "My father was a freedom fighter, and I'm a freedom fighter's son. And I'll stick to the freedom ride till every battle's won." Well, the jailers went wild at our singing because we were singing as loudly as we could, and our voices were wafting out over the city of Jackson. And the windows were open. They would come in and slam our windows shut, and we would open them again and sing more and more and more. Other freedom riders, the black women in another wing, the white men in another wing, the white women in another wing would pick up the song, and so the jailhouse was rocking with freedom song. The jailers are running around saying, "Stop that singing! Stop that singing! Stop it!" And we continued singing because it was good for our morale. It was good for our morale, and if there were any fear left in us, that fear was dissipated by the song.
What did they do to try to prevent you from singing after closing the window and yelling at you didn't work?
Well, in Parchman, the state penitentiary, said, "If you don't stop that singing, we'll take away your mattresses." Well, now that sounds like a juvenile threat, but it was an important threat because the little thin straw mattress was the only comfort we had. Everything else was cold, hard stone and steel in those tiny little cells. But there was this little mattress, which was comfort, which was a symbol of home, symbol of domesticity. And now they're going to take that away. We'd have nothing else. Well, that caused some people to stop singing for a while, until one young man who was a Bible student reminded everybody what they were doing. Said, here they're trying to take your soul away, you see. It's not the mattress, it's your soul. And then one freedom rider yelled, "Guards! Guards! Guards!" And the deputy came running out into the cell block to see what was wrong. And this freedom rider shouted, "Come get my mattress. I'll keep my soul." And then song exploded again. We began singing. Then another time. I have to laugh when I think of this. One freedom rider was complaining that this deputy, who was in charge of the guards, always called us boy, you boys. He said, "Why does he always call us boy? We are men. I think we ought to refuse to answer until he calls us men." Another one reminded him that that was just a custom down south, and he didn't mean anything derogatory by it. So this fellow said, "I think I'll ask him." He called Deputy Tyson. Said, "Deputy Tyson, what?" Says, "Do you mean anything derogatory when you call us boy?" Deputy Tyson said, "I don't know nothing about no rogatory. All I know is if you boys don't stop that singing, you're going to be singing in the rain." And then somebody started singing again. They pulled in a high-pressure fire hose and washed us all down with it. We tumbled over and everything was floating in the water in our cells. One of the freedom riders then yelled, "Deputy Tyson, next time you're going to do that, bring us some soap so we can take a shower."
The late James Farmer talking about the Freedom Riders in a 1985 interview. My guest Raymond Arsenault is the author of the new book Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. The book is part of the Oxford University Press series Pivotal Moments in American History. Arsenault is a professor of Southern history at the University of South Florida. Raymond Arsenault, welcome to Fresh Air. We heard James Farmer describing that the Freedom Riders didn't want to be bailed out of the Parchman prison. What was the philosophy behind that jail-no-bail approach they took?
This was one of the most controversial innovations of the Congress of Racial Equality. There had been talk about jail-no-bail for years in the late 1950s, but no one had either marshaled enough courage or audacity to try it on any kind of mass level. And the first jail no bail actually took place in Tallahassee, Florida. A young activist named Patricia Stevens and several other activists decided to take Gandhian philosophy literally and to fill the jails as best they could. And then there was another jail no bail incident in Rock Hill, South Carolina in early 1961, and this gave the Corps, or Congress of Racial Equality, leaders hope that this could become kind of standard operating procedure in the movement. But the Freedom Rides was really the first time that this was tried on any kind of mass level.
Why was it controversial within the civil rights movement?
It seemed to go against common sense. It seemed counterintuitive, I think, to a lot of people. Thurgood Marshall made a famous statement in Nashville when he was lecturing at Fisk, and he was criticizing the jail no bail, and he said, "For God's sake, if somebody can get you out, get out. Take the offer. Anybody who knows what it's like to be in a southern jail, to be a black person or even a white person who's a dissenter in jail, knows it's a very dangerous place to be." So Marshall was taking perhaps the more pragmatic view, but jail no bail became a badge of honor and a elemental strategy for CORE during the early 1960s.
Was it a troublesome mood for the prison authorities because they had to deal with all of these civil rights activists who were being very disruptive to the prison system?
I think it was very confounding for them. They were accustomed to intimidating people, to particularly young people. They had all kinds of ways of manipulating and threatening and in many cases actually physically harming people and you know, southern jails and particularly southern prisons, Parchman being the most notorious, but even the county jails and the city jails, they weren't accustomed to people trying to stay inside the bars, and so it defied logic for them, and they didn't know quite how to deal with it, and never, I think, really figured out a way to counter the tactics of these pesky kids and their allies.
So when the Freedom Riders refused to post bail, how did they get out of prison?
Well, in the case of most of the Freedom Riders who ended up behind bars in Mississippi, more than 300 ended up in Parchman Prison, there was a quirk of Mississippi law which said you had to get out before 40 days to be able to file an appeal. And, of course, ultimately what the Congress of Racial Equality and the Freedom Riders and the other organizations involved wanted to do was to create a test case to force the legal justice system, if possible, at the local and state level, but at least at the federal level, to endorse and to sustain and protect their constitutional rights. So they needed these appeals. So they would stay in for 39 days, but they would get out on time so that they could file their appeals in the Mississippi case. And almost all the southern states had some quirks like this. Part of the game in the Freedom Rides between the white segregationists and the Freedom Riders was a test of resources. They kept increasing the bond that they had to post. They tried to break the civil rights movement financially. They knew that resources were limited and that most of those resources were with the NAACP, which had an ambivalent attitude towards the Freedom Rides, that there was a feeling that by going into prison on a mass level was subjecting the civil rights movement to a lot of pressure, making it more vulnerable, that the Freedom Rides was an enormous gamble. If all this money was poured into it and there were no positive results, then this movement would be set back, that it would not advance. So there were a lot of people within the movement who had very serious questions about the wisdom of playing this very dangerous game.
My guest is Raymond Arsenault, author of the new book Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.